Great. And Marshall, if you can go ahead and call the next case, please.
The next case is case number A231416, Durdall versus Wallenberg et al.
And good morning, counsel. Today is March 6th. We're at the Minnesota Court of Appeals via Zoom. The argument will be recorded and there'll be an audio available after the argument. My name is Judge Schmidt. I'm presiding today here with Judge Sleater and Judge Klopaki. The appellant counsel, you will have 15 minutes for your opening and 5 minutes for your rebuttal. Respondents counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for your argument. Appellant's counsel, when you're ready, you can go ahead and proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. My name is Dave McLaughlin, and I'm an attorney representing Greg Durdall in this matter. We're here today, and we believe the case is a matter of simple statutory construction and interpretation. Facts of the case are that there was a lease of farmland in 2009 and 2010. As part of the lease, there was an option to purchase, and it had for a set price and a time frame in that lease. The lease was honored by the parties because Greg Durdall paid the rent, and basically the trust accepted the performance of Mr. Durdall. Mr. Durdall made improvements to the lease property, and so those things were there. The trial court in this case found that Durdall could not enforce the lease because the lease was made with David Wallenberg, a brother of the trustees of the trust. And what is unique about this is that Greg Durdall paid David Wallenberg the money, and that everybody knew that Greg Durdall was farming the property.
Mr. McLaughlin, I have a question for you, but before I do, I notice you're getting a little extra time. At least on my version of the clock, it doesn't look like it's running. There we go. Okay. Thank you, Marshall. My question, Mr. McLaughlin, kind of getting to the heart of it, I know that your client argues in an opposition to our court's Green-Kellen case, but before even getting to the perhaps policy argument I know you made perhaps in your second or third part of your brief, factually, that court made it clear, and it kind of seems to apply here, that a farmer, unless the debt is incurred while farming, would not fit that statute just by literally reading the statute. And here, the basis, as I understand the judgment, wasn't based on him not paying a loan or requiring inputs, borrowing money, and then can't paying it. It was a slander of title, which wasn't even part of his claim, direct claim, but was the counterclaim. So how just literally reviewing, in fact, the Green Court kind of made it clear, a farmer who happens to have a debt, unless the debt's incurred in farming, that simply just doesn't fit the statute. And so that's even before we get the argument of intentional tort. So how do you get around that here, that the money judgment was not related to farming, but related to committing a slander of title?
The lease was involved in the transaction. The lease was farmland. Greg Durdall farmed the property in question. The lease said he had an option to purchase the property. He tried to enforce that agreement. And that's why it is. It's all relating to the farming operation. This is the same as Westchester the Pass Bargain involved a contract for the delivery of grain. It didn't matter where the grain was done or anything else. It was basically, was it involved in the farming operation? This is clearly involved in the farming operation of Greg Durdall. That's the only reason for the lease, and it's the same as anything else. It's the same as buying chemicals, fertilizer, inputs. Well, so this is directly on point with that.
So, but is that contrary to the Green case? Meaning he is a farmer who did have a lease, but as I understand, by the time the specific performance action he commenced, he was no longer leasing the property. Is that correct?
No, he had exercised previously, and then then he sued on the exercise, which was refused by the trust. So
but what I'm getting at is how does one can sue on a specific performance, I understand that, without committing slander of title. But here, the slander of title is what creates the judgment debt, not his farming it or even suing for specific performance, correct? Other than it was the counterclaim, I understand.
It relates to that because the lease, the slander of title related to the filing of the lease, and that was done by Greg Dierdal's father, or it was in relation to the notice of lis pendens, which was filed by Mr. Dierdal's attorney before the complaint was filed. So those were the two elements of slander of title. The one occurred in 2010 while he was actively farming the operation. The other one actually was part of the enforcement, but that was done by Mr. Dierdal's then attorney. So it does arrive out of the lease, and it's perfectly clear that's what went on here. Basically, when a court looks at the factors in green, you have to have a judgment for unpaid balance of debt. We have that. Debt on agricultural property. Agricultural property is defined as property used in the farming operation. The lease was used in the farming operation, and the debt was incurred in the operation of the farm. That's clear because of the lease. So there's no question that this arose out of farming operation. In green, the court's reminded that that was a claim of conversion of some personal property and a slander relating to statements that were made by Mr. Kellen regarding the character of Mr. Green. That's totally not related to the farming operation. This one is entirely related to the farming operation. So we believe that the statute applies, and the court got it wrong. We think that Green v. Kellen was an oversimplification of the issues. You can go into other torts, which would be a result of the farming operation. For example, cows got out and damaged the neighbor's crop. That would be an operation of the farm, but the farm, that would constitute an intentional tort under Green, and the farmer could not get out of the, wouldn't be protected by this statute. Other claims would be just simple trespass. There's a boundary dispute. Person believed he had the right to farm the property or harvest the crop. He turns out to be wrong. That would be not covered by the statute because it's intentional torts. The purpose of the statute in question was to protect farmers from repeated collection efforts on the part of creditors. The court will remember that back in the 80s, the farm situation in rural Minnesota was, to put it bluntly, horrendous. Basically, there were crosses pounded into the courthouse lawns showing all the farmers that were foreclosed out of that county. There were penny auctions where the banks tried to sell the property. There were just demonstrations all over the place. That's why the legislature passed this rule to basically protect farmers from collection activity after 3 years. The plaintiff in this, the respondent in this case, had 3 years to collect on the debt. The respondent did nothing in those 3 years. They didn't do anything for 6 years. And then they came and tried to collect the proper debt on the property. That is contrary to what the statute was. The statute is supposed to be liberally construed on behalf of the farmer. And when you read the legislative history, that's exactly what it said. Up until Green, every court that looked at this case came to the same conclusion.
That basically the farmers... Counsel, would we have to overrule Green to rule in your favor?
You wouldn't have to overrule Green. What you have to do is limit Green to the facts of that case. It was an intentional tort based upon slander. And then the slander was basically calling into character Mr. Green's public reputation. That's what the slander was in that case. And then the conversion, obviously, if the conversion was there, conversion is an intentional tort, and that's not included here. So you wouldn't have to do those. What you have to do is just limit it to those facts. You don't have to overrule it totally.
But the holding in Green says it the statute does not apply to judgment debts resulting from intentional torts. Now, that's a fairly broad holding, and we have an intentional tort here. So it seems like we would have to overrule that.
Yes. We believe that's the case, and we believe that is the proper action to take because of the if you take into account all of the legislative history and the rest of it, that's what farmers received. They're entitled to that action. The legislature favors farmers over other matters, and that was not discussed at all in Green versus Kellen. The parties in Green versus Kellen weren't concerned about anything other than the slander of the Kellens talking about Mr. Green or the conversion of the equipment. They didn't go into all the other myriad of potential torts that are out there.
What you're saying is that we would have to limit Green to the kind of intentional tort that existed in that case, as opposed to what looks to me like slander of title also being an intentional tort.
Correct, Your Honor. That's what we believe the court should do in this case, because Green is just totally overbroad from what...
What you're saying is that the statement about applying to intentional torts was a misstatement of that case, because that case involved a specific kind of slander. Is that what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying, Your Honor. And the parties in Green did not address any other torts or any other actions. They never made the claim. All intentional torts are not covered by the statute. That's something that is entirely different, and the court did that itself. And we believe that was an error when the court did that. So, you know, because basically the issues are basically that, you know, like the court said, you'd limit Green to the facts of that case or those specific types of statute. Other intentional torts comes up, the court can rule one way or the other on them. And that seems to be the proper way to do it, as opposed to just blanket saying all intentional torts are, because this one is a case that is totally different from Green. You can come up with other intentional torts that would have exactly the same effect. And
Mr. McLaughlin, would you agree that the Green case was the first time the issue was presented? And I did see it in the respondent's brief there. I can't remember if I saw it in the appellant's brief, but it was replied to, as I recall. But would you say that it's never before arisen the specific question of whether intentional torts were intended as part of that statute?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, that was the whole situation. And we considered actually filing a brief in that case, but we didn't think the court would enter a judgment to the effect that it did. It covered so broad, because every case up to that time favored the farmers.
Well, but there has never been a case up to that time, though, involving a farmer committing an intentional tort and then wanting to apply the statute, correct?
That went to the Court of Appeals, correct.
So my point being, it looked like the court in Green did do a bit of a twofold analysis, the first being just factually, and that's kind of what we started to talk about today, whether a farmer who happens to have a judgment means that is a farmer judgment pursuant to the statute. So you have to look into the facts of how that judgment is obtained. But then secondly, said to the extent it was ambiguous, did look at the legislative history, the same history you're referring to, and concluded that there's no basis for including intentional torts. And just kind of a question, since that's the theme of your argument here today, wouldn't it be safe to say that there's a reasonable public policy argument that there's no sympathy for someone who commits an intentional tort versus someone who simply, because of the market prices, that was the case in the 80s, could not afford to pay back their land payments or their inputs? Do you see the distinction there?
The distinction is there, but the difference again comes into farmers have a specific protection that others do not have. The respondent had 3 years to try to collect the property, collect its debt. It didn't. It didn't do anything for 6 years. And if there's sympathy for this, it's what was the what was the respondent doing in that time? The respondent argues that the defendant had the obligation to pay or the rest of the stuff. We had the obligation to maybe pay, but they had the remedies and they sat on their hands and did nothing. And that's what happened in this case. The time ran out on them. And that's happened other cases before. It happens with farm creditors that farm credit, for example, if they're going to claim conversion of a collateral, that would be an intentional tort. Those arguments have not survived at the trial court level. It hasn't been up to the Court of Appeals, obviously. But those things, that's been the practice of how things are handled. And it makes sense that that is the proper way for the court to deal with it. Let's see. Shuffling around here, sorry. Basically, when it's just going forward, when these actions are going to continue to occur, and the court should define exactly, okay, what is covered by the statute or what is not covered by the statute. If the court says all intentional torts are covered, that's going to cause a lot of trouble out in the community. If they do specifically to conversion of non-related farm equipment, that makes sense. Slander of a person's reputation, that makes sense. But this lease is entirely out of the farm operation. And it should be, the court should find in behalf of the appellant and reverse the matter and send it back to the trial court. With that, I will save the 20 seconds or whatever I have left. Probably lost them anyway, because I used it without the clock running. So I'll do that.
All right. And you will have
five questions.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal, counsel. And so if you can go ahead and mute yourself and then counsel for respondent, go ahead and unmute and you'll have 15 minutes when you're when you start your presentation.
Good morning, and may it please the court, counsel. I'm Pat O'Neill. I'm one of the attorneys representing the trustees of the Wallenberg Family Trust, Jamie Wallenberg and Susan Huerta. The sole question on appeal is whether the district court erred in applying Green versus Kellen in rejecting Dierdl's attempt to avoid collection of the 2016 judgment. The answer is no. The district court, relying on Green, properly determined that Minnesota Statute 550.366, its 3-year limitation on the collection of farm debts, did not apply to the trust 2016 judgment entered against Dierdl for the intentional tort of slander of title. The standard of review is de novo. Error is never presumed. Dierdl cannot and does not attempt to establish that the district court erred in applying Green. Instead, as he did today, he argues that Green was wrongly decided and that the Court of Appeals went outside the issues before it in arriving at their decision that intentional torts.
I don't know if it's true that counsel said that Green was wrongly decided. He said that the statement in the Green case may have been overly broad when based upon the facts of that case. When we talk about holdings of cases, we talk about a legal principle applied to specific facts. The specific facts there was a personal slander. That may be somewhat different from a slander of title, don't you agree?
I think that the elements of slander and defamation are very similar, actually. And here's what the jury found that Mr. Dierdl did. The jury found that he made a false statement regarding property owned by the trust. That false statement was both published and recorded. As counsel mentioned, it was published and recorded more than once. And the false statement was made with malice. As a result of that slander of title, the trust sustained consequential damages and was also entitled to special damages, which is the basis of the judgment the trust attempted to collect. Very little distinction to be drawn between defamation and slander of title, given the elements of the cause of action and the jury's specific findings here, specifically that malice finding. The malice finding goes beyond.
There is a difference, though, between a personal slander and the slander of title, which references the title to real estate, isn't there?
Yes, there's a distinction to be drawn there, but I'm not sure that the farm debt statute recognizes that distinction.
Well, that's what we're arguing about, aren't we?
Exactly. I think that the issue here is that
Why shouldn't the slander of title that arises out of a lease and a farming operation be considered differently than a personal slander?
Because it's an intentional tort, Your Honor, and so that is founded
on
wrong.
Why? That's just generally descriptive of a lot of things. Why specifically should a slander of title be considered the same kind of thing for the purposes of this statute as a personal slander?
Because the debt is not based on a default of an obligation or non-payment for farm goods or something akin to a traditional farm debt. Instead, the debt is predicated.
It clearly involved the farming operation and a claimed lease on that operation.
The debt was based on wrongful conduct by Mr. Dirdl. It was not based on any legitimate farming activity that he was undertaking. Instead, it's clearly outside the scope of any operation of a family farm. It's an intentionally wrongful act that was done with malice. That's what the jury found. That's the basis for the judgment. And that fact that it's based on wrongful conduct rather than the default of an obligation like we had in Westchester or Glacial Plains, I think is very significant for the purposes of the farm debt statute. Specifically, the fact that the debt must be based on, quote, on agricultural property. That means the debt must be based on personal property used in a farm operation. This judgment debt, again, is based on wrongful conduct done by Mr. Dirdl, not on any personal property he used in that farming operation or owned or attempted to make use of to further the farming operation. It's the conduct, not the fact of the liability that is important here.
Mr. O'Neill, can I follow up with that a little bit factually? Because if I understand from the record, and I assume this was part of what the jury was considering in terms of whether there was a slander, is that the documents were not filed publicly until after appellant became aware that the landlord, I guess if we use the phrase landlord, was not really the owner of the property, so didn't have authority to sell. Is that correct?
I believe the timing is correct, Your Honor, but we're not here to relitigate the merits.
No, my question I'm getting at is this, because appellant's making the argument today that they had a right to pursue a specific performance based on that language. My question is, could that have been done without committing a slander of title?
I believe it could have, but it wasn't. And so they commenced their lawsuit for specific performance, the trust counterclaims for slander of title. The specific performance counts are dismissed at the summary judgment stage. Slander of title action goes forward to trial.
Is it accurate? Did the record reflect that, in fact, the trust received the proceeds from the purported lease?
Your Honor, I am not 100% sure about the record there, but I know that the judgment, if they in fact received the proceeds of that lease payment, I believe there would have been a fact issue on the specific performance claim. So I think that was addressed by the trial court and disposed of at summary judgment. The only issues that went to trial and the only issues that gave rise to the slander of title debt are those slander of title claims.
What does the record reflect about who, if anybody, received the payments on the purported lease?
Your Honor, I'm not, I don't have that at my fingertips right now, but I can assure you that there was no appeal of the summary judgment order, nor was there an appeal that was fully pursued from the jury verdict. That appeal, I believe, was dismissed, and instead the plaintiff elected to file a lawsuit against his lawyer stemming from the judgment credit. The judgment entered against him. But those facts are settled. They gave rise to the judgment debt. And the only issue we have here is whether or not the district court was entitled to rely on the holding of the Green case, which was that, quote, the unambiguous plain language of the farm debt statute and legislative intent demonstrate that the judgment debt resulting from intentional torts is not covered by the statute, end quote. This isn't a remark made in passing. It's found at least five times. Something similar is found at least five times in the decision. And it's in fact referenced in the syllabus point. I believe that this language cannot be dismissed as dicta. And the best evidence of the fact that this court was within its discretion to address that intentional tort issue is the fact that the Minnesota Supreme Court declined to review that decision after it was issued. Had the court exceeded the scope of its authority or gone outside the issues that were in front of it, the Supreme Court would have stepped in to correct that. They didn't. And I think that that's very significant. And I know that I believe that it's significant for district court judges evaluating cases and making decisions. They have every right to rely on precedential decisions from this court, especially where they're clear. And that's exactly what the Green case was here. It clearly said that the farm debt statute does not apply to debts arising from intentional torts. I don't think that the district courts should be in the business of examining this court's decisions to divine what counts as dicta or obiter dictum or judicial dictum, and instead should be able to rely on the clear language of the opinion, especially in cases where the Supreme Court has declined to alter the holding or any aspect of that decision. Pages 8 and 9 of our brief include all the references to the fact that intentional torts are not covered by the farm debt statute. I direct the court there for further support on that issue.
Mr. O'Neill, I see you argued it in your brief, as I recall, and it's kind of similar to what the Green-Kellen case did, is that it first started with literally just simply interpreting the statute to the facts of the case and first ruling that it was not a farm debt under that statute. Would you agree that's the case here, too, before we even get into discussion of intentional tort, because this is not a debt incurred while farming, which essentially, as defined, would be a debt not paying your mortgage, not paying your inputs, et cetera?
I think that the district court correctly relied on the Green decision's discussion of intentional torts in granting summary judgment. But we can start from the point of the statute and the three factors of that statute, which are, you know, is there a judgment for an unpaid debt? Is that debt on agricultural property, or was that debt incurred? And was that debt incurred in the operation of the family farm? The second two factors are dispositive here. The debt wasn't on agricultural property, as I discussed earlier. It's on wrongful conduct. It's on the slander of title that gave rise to that judgment. It's not on an existing obligation. It's not as if Mr. Deardle received something for value that he was supposed to pay for later and then later defaulted. This is something completely different. It's a slander of title. He made a false statement. He recorded that false statement, and he made that statement with malice, causing damage to the trust. And the third factor, again, was it incurred in the operation of a family farm? I don't believe slander of title or any other intentional tort could be considered to be, done in the operation of a family farm or any legitimate operation of a family farm. We've discussed hypotheticals, including trespass by animals. I think trespass by animals is an intentional tort. However, actual damages aren't required, and normally only nominal damages are available. So the intentional tort of trespass would never give rise to the type of debt that the farm statute is designed to protect against, unless the trespass was done knowingly. And we've cited the statute on that, then there's treble damages available. Well, a knowing trespass obviously would not be within the operation of legitimate operation of a family farm. That would be something else. That would be something intentional and therefore wrongful that the farm debt statute doesn't apply to. The farm debt statute likewise wouldn't apply to a restitution debt, a civil fine, or some type of other penalty that a farmer may incur for, you know, cultivating illegal crops or disposing of farm byproducts in a manner that violates environmental regulations. Obviously, the farm statute was not designed to protect farmers from that type of wrongful conduct. And that logic should carry through to intentional torts as well. Lastly, we've discussed legislative intent here. Every court that's examined the farm debt statute has determined that it's unambiguous. So a resort to legislative history isn't necessarily necessary. However, it's been done in multiple decisions. And the clear outcome of that examination has been that the farm debt statute was, quote, enacted to encourage Minnesotans to pursue the farming as a profession despite the financial risks involved. Committing intentional torts is not a financial risk of farming. That's simply a fact. Committing intentional torts is a risk of wrongful conduct. Wrongful conduct could be done by anybody. It couldn't be done, doesn't have to be done by a farmer. It could be done by anybody. But that's what brings it outside the scope of the farm debt statute. And as decided in Green, quote, the legislature intended to provide farmers with a means to avoid there's no evidence that the legislature intended to provide farmers with a means to avoid or delay responsibility for their own intentional wrongful actions. That's exactly what we have here. We have the intentional wrongful act of committing slander of title. Again, false statement recorded and published on more than one occasion and done with malice. I think that that brings this conduct outside the scope of the farm debt statute and should permit my clients to continue to collect on the that judgment debt within the 10-year time period authorized by the statute governing all judgments. If there's no further questions, I will yield the remainder of my time.
Thank you, counsel. I'm not seeing any other questions. So we will turn back to counsel for appellant. You will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Basically, a couple of points that have to be addressed here. You have to remember that the lease was filed in 2010 by Mr. Dirdall's father. If that was a slander of title, they obviously leased it. The terms of the lease were not altered. It is exactly what it was. You can't tell from the trial court's initial response was which was the statute that which was the wrongful conduct that constituted the slander of title. Was it the recorded lease or was it the subsequent notice of lis pendens filed? And the notice of lis pendens was filed again by Mr. Dirdall's attorney. That was filed after the time was done, but it was not done properly because the attorney should have filed the complaint before he filed the notice of lis pendens. Those were the facts of the case. Then with regard to trying to read it, I know it's here, I'm sorry. It was done, the all of the leases and the recordings were done in the operation of the family farm. This is entirely different than Green versus Kellen. If the court looks at the total circumstances of this case, the Dirdalls leased the property, paid rent, and I believe the record would show that the rent was paid to David Wallenberg and his mother. I believe that's what the record would show, but I'm not sure that it went directly to the mother, but the mother knew about it. And I believe the record would back that up. So the Wallenbergs knew Greg Dirdall was out there farming the property. They knew their brother was not farming the property. They've never disavowed the lease until the lawsuit was commenced. And that's when it started to go downhill. By that time, all of the supposed intentional torts had already been committed and there was nothing more to do. When the trial court found that summary judgment, the lease was actually the court found that it was an assignment of a lease with David Wallenberg. It was not just a lease that David Wallenberg did. So that was the factual circumstances back at that time. So the lease was with David Wallenberg and he paid the rent and the trust got the money. They knew about it. And that's what Greg Dirdall tried to enforce. And that was his basis for his conduct. If you take a farmer and the farmer loses 500 acres of farmland, in the spring of a growing season. It causes a big problem for the farmer. He's got committed up for, he's committed for seed, chemical, bird. He's probably signed contracts to deliver, to sell the grain off of the time. So he has to defend those claims. And it's very common to see litigation over lease terminations and the rest of the arguments. So we believe this is entirely different than Green, and the court should reverse, well, clarify Green to say that it applies to those specific types of facts and not as a general, all intentional torts are barred. I think that's basically all I have to say, and we'll rest on our arguments. So unless there's questions.
I'm not seeing any questions. So we thank both counsel for your arguments today and your briefs. The case is submitted and we will issue a decision within the statutory timeframe. And with that, that concludes our oral argument calendar for